Hi everyone, Anthony Fantano here, internet's busiest music nerd, and it is time for another episode of the TND podcast with a special artist interview. Mr. Ash Kusha, a London-based electronic music producer who dropped one of the most perplexing records I've heard this year, Good, an album that I have still been trying to make heads or tails of since I reviewed it. And that is exactly why I have Mr. Kusha himself on the show today to sort of shed some light on his creative process, on the creative process that went into this record, and a bit of his sort of musical background. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks. It's good to be on your channel. I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Yeah. Give us a bit of a rundown of what the reception of this record has been since you dropped it. I mean, I know you sort of released it onto SoundCloud originally as kind of like this holistic piece with a lot of different musical movements within it. I don't believe it was sort of separated out into numerous tracks as it is now.
You mean when I made it?
Yeah. Good.
Well, what I usually do is like I try to do a long track where I go back and forth and put in sound, and I try to shape it at the end. But with this one, since it was the first record that I tried to do it within this method, basically, I had to chop it 3 or 4 times and bring it back together. So at some points, I felt that it was cut out, but then it came out as one seamless track, basically.
And well, since then, it has been chopped up into other songs, and it landed on the old English Spelling Bee record label.
Yeah. But what we thought is it's good to have the single experiences as well. But I'm sure if you listen to it as a whole piece or in different, like, say, in single tracks, basically, they're connected together still. So I wanted to give this chance also to have people listening to each track, since so many people wouldn't get the time to have a 43 minutes experience in the audio platform, since we don't have the video platform.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the thing is that I think people these days really have more time than they realize that they do. And I think once people see that maybe a piece is like 40 or so minutes and it's just kind of this one big, long, connected piece of music, they might kind of roll their eyes and groan. But the thing is, if they heard that kind of one moment in them, in that one track, in that long piece that sort of connected with them, if they were able just to kind of reach and hear that one moment, they would be interested in hearing the rest of the 40 minutes of the piece.
Yeah, I think it's like the 60s and 70s, especially 70s. I remember when I was a kid, I was watching these videos of bands, like progressive bands, doing like 20 minute jammings.
Sure.
And I think I was really fascinated by the whole thing, that you wouldn't really feel the 20 minutes pass. So I think we should kind of, I wouldn't say we should, but yeah, it's cool to go back to that kind of with electronic music, with the new format that we're listening to. Go back to that whole like long experience and just get involved, really get engaged with the whole sonic experience.
And from what I understand, you are pretty involved with, or you have a pretty deep history with classical music as well. And I imagine that has to sort of inform the process that you went into this record with, at least in the sort of format that you made it in, where even though it is these kind of separate moments, it does feel like this one long massive piece.
Yeah, I was studying classical music when I was around 20. For 4 years, I studied classical composition, and I really like the form and structure in classical music, the composition, the way they put sound together and make this whole the big wall of sound, basically, with different instruments in different registers, basically. But something was missing for me personally, which was the sound wasn't too too expandable. It was limited to certain instruments in classical music. So I always try to do classical music with noise, or even just random sounds that I would find or record with my field recorder. So
I feel like classical music, as I'm sure you already know, is just so heavily dependent on the instrumental palette it's sort of infamous for. You know, just as like rock music is really, really heavily dependent on bass guitar and just regular six-string guitar and the westernized drum set as we know it. So sort of pulling those instruments out of that context completely, out of the classical formula, how do you make sort of electronic sounds and noises translate into kind of a classical flavor? Like, once you've pulled those instruments out, how exactly do you go into the creative process mindset?
Yeah, imagine you're making up a chord sequence or just putting, like harmonizing sounds in a way you would harmonize a contrabass with, let's say, a viola or a cello. So I imagine I'm doing that. I try to put electronic sounds instead. So the outcome is most of the time some random chord sequence, which is like it's basically based on randomness and chaos, but it all comes together at the end since you're trying to be in a form. So for me, the experience is kind of open-ended for me still. I'm trying randomness within structure, kind of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's definitely something that shows on this new record over here. There's a lot of electronic music out today, especially in the wake of UK bass and future garage and sort of micro house getting pretty popular, as well as deep house and a lot of this newer, poppier EDM stuff.
Yeah,
a lot of it is sort of based on these either meditative or just really physical repeating grooves that are meant to sort of elicit some kind of, you know, physical response. Whereas what you're doing, it's not that it's not coherent, but it's really disorienting. You know, there's no one single pattern that just repeats again and again and again and again. And yet it doesn't feel totally random, like a classical composition. It does feel very decided, and even when it does kind of go in a direction where you don't expect, it feels like it knows where it's going and it knows where it wants to go.
Yeah, I treat sound like theatrical performers, so I don't put them on the grid. I don't put them on the metronome. I let them just flow. When I'm playing the keyboard, I don't restrict myself on the grid or I have to be on the metronome. So I try to perform a sort of behavior, sonic behavior, and then put them with others and see how they react to each other. And it's like a stage, basically, of sound that are involved with each other. And at the end, you have this kind of performance that switches into another performance and another performance. So yeah, I'm entertaining my kind of sonic pleasures, sort of.
So the process is you might sort of write or maybe even improvise this idea on a keyboard, and then after it's kind of out there, you'll kind of rewind and think back, well, how do I sort of complement this with other sounds now, is sort of the idea?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm acting. I'm just saying a line, and I go back. I reply to that. I respond to that line.
Sure, sure. And so simultaneously, in one breath, you're writing lines for the other actors to sort of interact with this lead role that you've developed. Or maybe, I'm sure, in the process of creation, you're writing something that you might think is the lead role at the time, but then a more significant idea that you would like to put in the spotlight maybe pops up in the creative process or of writing roles for the other lines. But in your head simultaneously, you've got to be thinking of what you're going to be doing 5 minutes from then, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's always a lead line that is the most stubborn and it's just moving around and it just gets away from the grid. And then while playing it, I'm kind of writing something else. So I know what this behavior is going to bring to the other one. So it's, yeah, it's just step by step, layering in my head and just bringing them out, sort of. It's really hard to explain these in words.
No, it is very hard to explain, and it's hard to even imagine it sort of even happening. But yet, you know, we have the album here. We know it must have happened. But sort of with that being your creative process, when do you even know when to stop? You know, when do you know? Oh, this is done now. This album is very done.
Interesting because this one was basically around 65 minutes, so I had to cut out from the 65 minutes as well. And the initial recording was around 80 minutes, so I just keep playing and playing, and sometimes it's a really long piece of composition. I have to cut out the long moments, the longer moments.
Sure, you've got to edit yourself.
So yeah, sometimes you just keep on playing. Yeah.
Okay, so going a little into the compositional aspect of it. Another thing about this record that was striking to me and sort of seems like a really significant part of the process is just the sound craft of this album. I mean, completely separate from what you're going to be doing in terms of the percussion and the melodies on this record. Some of these sounds sound like before you even thought of what the sound would be doing melodically, you were kind of just honing it and crafting it and making sure it had a certain timbre or a certain pitch to it.
Yeah, I do that. I design sound before I put it on the keyboard and start to make compositions out of it, basically.
Sure.
So that's the first process, just to make the sound. I might spend 2 days searching for the right sound within the archive I have. I've recorded so many sounds from nature, environment, sampled sounds. So I just dig in and select my sound and work on it. And,
are there any sort of unexpected or sort of strange samples of things that end up on this record that sort of just listening to it, the audience probably wouldn't think that, I didn't think that was a car door slamming or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of glass sound and tick sound. Like I was just drops of water. I was just pouring water and sampling it, which is weird because you can it's funny how you can turn drops of water into snares. I found that really interesting. Yes, you can easily have a really fat snare or click sound from water drops. I would say the most interesting one for me was the water samples, but how I used the sample was the thing that I talked about in the press release as well, which is the nano composition, which the easiest way to explain this is by saying it's all about scale. Nanotechnology is all about scale. So I'm trying to bring the concept of scale and size of sound in waveforms, in music. And it's basically digging deep, like zooming in so much into sound that you almost find really, really weird grains of and movements of sound, basically, like random creatures that are random objects that come to you. And I take them out, I bring them back into the normal size, I put them together sometimes, and they make a really weird synth. So I'm kind of letting things happen as well on their own, letting this world of grains and sounds talk to me, and I respond to them, and then I find something new. Because I don't want to be preparing things. The whole surprise element, I think, is really exciting in music. So most of the time, when you know so much about how you do things, it's the most dangerous for your music to be something new.
Yeah, I think I get what you're saying because, I mean, how do you keep yourself surprised when you're just making music by yourself? You know, like when you're in a group of musicians, the element of surprise can a lot of the time come from the fact that you're working with other people and they do something completely unexpected or just some present some idea that you hadn't thought of. And when you're working by yourself, I imagine the element of surprise can be kind of like something that you chase after really hard.
Yeah, the element of surprise is more in the sound design than the composition.
Sure.
Yeah, so yeah, I try to get surprised from how this sound would end up being when I dig deep into the grains and use a lot of granular synthesis. You never know what's going to happen at the end because it's not very mathematical. It's very experience-based method. So you basically manipulate sound to see what's going to happen next. And the moment you feel that's good, it's you just take it. And that's your gift, basically. It's like your...
Interesting.
It's like a game. It's like a video game.
Sure.
It's kind of full of surprises. And one thing I was thinking is that... actually, today I was talking to a friend about this, that I would really like to play this music to intelligent machines in the future somehow. Like, I think
you would love to have an audience of machines in the future.
Yeah, but I was thinking like the AIs. Imagine 100 years from now, we have AIs, we have intelligent machines, like super intelligent machinery, and I would like to see their reaction. They're going to be a part of us as individual beings.
They would probably be really pretentious and shit on it just because they knew a human made it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point, because they would probably never. They would probably never
be like, "Ugh, a human made this? Ugh, get this out of my face."
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. It would be a weird experience. Yeah.
Sure. Well. So the composition, we have the sound craft, tell me a little bit more before we jump into the next thing, sort of how the reception of the record has been going so far, because, you know, I know before, I reviewed the record and Old English Spelling Bee featured the record on, their Bandcamp, the following on the album was relatively small. And, you know, so you're going from kind of being this virtually unknown artist to somebody that has, you know, a small audience kind of following them. And sort of what is that transition?
Which is amazing. It's just unbelievable. And that is another gift of technology. I mean, how fast things can happen these days.
Basically, what's the feeling from then to now? You know, because the, I have a lot of sort of young musicians and people who are just trying to get their music out there asking me all the time,
Let me say this. Yeah. For every musician, I think it's the same. If they don't tell you this, they're probably not telling the truth. But I think when you make something, you're really scared that, well, what did I just do? I don't know if people are going to like it or not. So the moment you see the response... You see, people are actually into it. They're trying to get engaged. They're trying to get involved with your music. That's the moment you know, okay, I have to carry on doing this. This is it. I'm going to do it. So you just keep doing it in the same fashion you did, and you're going to be confident that, okay, this is good. This is nice. This is like a scientist that makes sort of like invents a medicine or something. And if no one tests that and it's not positive, How do you know to carry on? You know, it's, for me, it was a really, really uplifter to see how people respond to this kind of music, which is risky music, in this whole environment of safe, kind of enjoyable, pleasurable electronic music, to do something that is totally off, and it's basically just bonkers.
Sure. No, I've had a lot of conversations with people who are also trying to get started in the YouTube realm, and I've said to them oftentimes before, you know, when you're just getting started and you have nobody watching and nobody responding, it can feel a lot like just screaming into the void of space. You know, you don't know. I mean, even though we kind of have this idea of what an artist should be or how an artist's creative process should go. You know, the artist should be totally influenced by no one and nothing. The artist should have full control of everything and, you know, be like this person who walks into the room wearing a cape and a hat and sort of throws their cape on the couch and poo-poos everybody they walk by. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that music is this communal thing. And, you know, unless you were, you know, sort of this guy, sort of like this R. Stevie Moore type, where you just kind of have this thing inside of you where you can't help but create, and it really doesn't matter whether it's good or bad, or anybody hears it, or, you know, 500 people hear it, or nobody hears it. You know, you're making this music in a way to sort of communicate, and if you have nobody to sort of communicate it to, it could be kind of confusing, you know, because you don't even know whether or not you're speaking correctly,
yeah.
I guess,
totally
in a sense.
I agree with that. It's really important when you have a concept with your music, and you probably think about something when you make that music, or have a feeling or expressing yourself because of some other emotional thing that happened, a process in your head maybe. But the moment even one person responds to that, that becomes important. It becomes a connection between you and the first listener. And then the second, the third, the hundredth, the thousands. So I think, yeah, as you said, it's a communal thing, and it's something that has to be spread as much as possible when you make it. I think it's a natural process as well, in a way. It will. People will get you if you just did something, and you just thought that this is what I think, this is what I believe, this is my emotions, and yeah.
So you talk about sort of having this audience for your music now, or having these people respond to your record and say that it sort of justified your creation in some kind of way. It's vindicated your process, and you're like, okay, I'm doing something here that people are responding to. So that signifies to me to keep going with it. But have you run into a point yet, or, you know, what do you think you'll do if you run into a point down the road where you have an interaction with your audience where it informs you to not continue doing what you're doing, but maybe change it in some kind of way?
I think, yeah, that's a interesting, well, wow, that's a very difficult one. Because I think, first of all, I do it for myself. And when I do it, I don't even know where I am.
Sure.
As an artist, I think most of the people who do music, they don't do it as a practice or as a job necessarily in the first point. They just do it. They just make it. The making process doesn't involve a lot of, I mean, any other person than yourself. So you're involved in that process, and you're the person who is making that melody line or the harmonies or putting sounds together. So at the end of the day, I think, yeah, at some point people might indicate, oh, we want this more from you, but you feel like, no, you don't want to do that anymore. And I think you will do whatever you want at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And some other people are going to come in and be positive about it, saying, oh, now he has changed. So it's a difficult one. I couldn't say that it justifies your work. But in the beginning, in the very beginning, it's very important to have feedback, basically. To know that someone is experiencing sound in the way you are experiencing it. But I don't know what's going to happen, I don't know, with your fifth album, if you're doing some other weird stuff and people are going to say, oh no, this is not good, or that is good, or I don't know.
I just wanted to sort of get your opinion early on before you wish your whole audience was dead and they're annoying the shit out of you. That's all. I'm kidding.
No. But what I meant was that this, because, well, we have this big debate nowadays about AIs, because I was reading something about Nick Bostrom, a philosopher.
You're very inspired by this topic. I want to point out, I think, you know, that there's a really interesting synthesis of, you know, sort of the digital world, but also kind of this really human organic component on this record. So,
exactly. That's where I stand. I stand on the human side of the thing. On the human side.
Sure.
So there's a whole wave discussing this, arguing about how AIs could be a big mistake. So I'm thinking we are AIs. We can be super human beings, super intelligent.
So you're kind of like actually. You're like the Terminator 2 outcome. If we do AIs,
yeah,
it's
kind of, I'm going for the
like
Terminator
that's what's going to happen. It's not going to be like yeah. Okay, so it's not so it'll be Terminator, but it's not even going to be a good Terminator. It'll be the worst
yeah.
Terminator. Okay.
Yeah, but used. Not
it won't be like that Robin Williams movie where he's the android and you know he's like learning to love and then they sort of turn him human by the end of the
yeah.
movie. It won't be like that. It'll be like
no,
Terminator.
It won't be, yeah. Yeah, it will be like that. I really like your references, man.
I'm just trying to work through what you're trying to say here.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to say that we could be the super intelligent people who can, because the basic idea of AI is just to move things faster in terms of intelligence and knowledge, and that's the main thing with AIs. And I think in music, we can move things, we can shake things around ourselves. We can go out of that box and just maybe don't even think about what we're doing. Just do some weird stuff and see what happens. If it's good, it's good. It's not. That's why the album is called Good. I thought this is good, but it's not perfect. And that's the biggest point human beings have. I think we do a lot of mistakes. And that's important.
Well, I think that's sort of where our obsession with stuff like AI sort of comes from. I think people want all of the advantages of the human condition, but they want to X out all the imperfections and all the mistakes using
exactly,
technology
yeah. Which,
and using robots.
Yeah, which I think the biggest mistake is to have machines that don't even make mistakes.
Sure.
And that, I think that's the biggest problem. If we want to make AIs, we have to make AIs that can make mistakes and learn from that.
Sure.
You know, because and they that's the way they're going to understand us, basically.
But I mean, at that point, I kind of feel like we've reached... At that point, once we've made AIs that are capable of making mistakes, I feel like we've just made ourselves.
Exactly.
You know?
That's well... Yeah, you can cut this off the interview, but I think that's the concept of God, basically. We're going to create God. The God that conceptually we created in our head. We're going to know that we are that.
Sure.
Basically.
Hey, that's staying in the interview, because that's an interesting point. Okay?
Okay.
This podcast is about music, but it's also about the weird, deep... conceptual
yeah.
philosophical stuff that informs it. You know, it's I don't think you could just I try as hard as possible to sort of look at music at least in the vacuum of okay, this album's new, I just listened to it, here's my reaction. But you know, if you're going to be sort of doing a long form podcast,
yeah,
you've got to sort
mean,
of talk about anything that sort of pops.
There's definitely more to it. Any
sure.
music, any music, there's definitely more to the music than
sure.
just the sound.
Yeah. So I think moving on from these awesome concepts that we were just discussing, and you know also audience reception. I want to ask you a little bit about sort of, so you're based in London right now.
Yeah.
You know, do you have any sort of connection with the scene out there as it currently stands with the music you've been making?
In what way? I mean, connection.
I mean, are you performing live? Are you collaborating with other people? Or are you just kind of like this lone island right now? I mean, as a result of this album coming out, is anybody sort of paying attention to what you're
doing?
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff coming. Mm-hmm. People contacting.
Like any opportunities to perform live out there?
Not yet with live music, because I think I'm going to wait to find the right platform to play live. Because... Mm-hmm. I think this should be accompanied with a lot of visuals, and I'm working on the visuals with Hirad, a friend of mine. And yeah, we're doing this whole thing with visuals that's going to come out soon. But as for the scene, I'm a bit of a caveman. I've been a bit of a caveman for the last couple of years, just experiencing new things and experimenting, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really like the scene in London. People are really challenging, and you see a lot of people from different places that are doing actually really weird stuff.
Is the just a quick detour? Is the Jamie XX record as huge over there as it is over here? Are people making a big deal of it over there?
I wouldn't be lying if I say I have no idea.
You have no idea. Well, that's fine too. Yeah. That's fine too. I mean, yeah. You know, if you're telling me you're a caveman, then, yeah. You know, and people aren't banging down your door with copies of the new Jamie XX record and saying, listen to this.
I know there's a track that is called Oh My Gosh or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's the intro track.
I just heard it somewhere, and it's just in my head for a long time. And
it's a catchy track.
I didn't know it was from Jamie XX, but I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, for a long time.
So your reaction to Oh My Gosh was Oh My Gosh?
Oh My Gosh, yeah.
Got it. Okay, so I mean, you know, you do have ambitions though to sort of be reaching out and sort of, you know, trying to perform this music in some kind of way though in the future.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to find the right place basically, because I had a bit of a weird experience 2 years ago. I was doing some other beat music, instrumental music, and I played. There was a funk night somewhere in East London, and I just played this weird ambient music, and people were like, "What is going on?"
So this music you've been creating before, this beat music, was this under another name, or was this sort of under the same pseudonym?
Yeah, it was some project called Slow Kid, which I just closed it down. It was just...
It's just completely...
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah, it's done.
And was that a completely different stylistic influence going into that project?
It was more ambient. I would say it was more spacey, atmospheric, non-beat music, basically. It was very... easy listening, kind of synthy, yeah.
Okay.
Airy. I don't know. It's really too hard to describe music.
And it can be. It can be.
Very difficult.
And not to sort of, you know, sort of pigeonhole you into anything as far as your next record, but at some point, you know, do you sort of see those influences creeping in a little bit more with what you're doing with this project at any point?
You mean the, like, for the future?
Yeah.
I think this is going to be a long term project. That is, it's an ongoing process. This whole nano composition and this thing with sound experience, because I think this first record wasn't the place to do everything. So I'm gonna catch up with things on the next and the next, hopefully, record if it comes out. Yeah.
You know, sort of talking about how difficult it is to describe music, how exactly do you feel like you would categorize what you do? Because me personally, I mean, when I came across the record and I was listening to it, I was like, wow, you know, it's blending so many things, but yet it's sort of coming out of, you know, this place that's completely unexpected at the same time. I'm not totally sure what label or labels to put on it. There were a few people that, you know, sort of came up afterwards and are like, Anthony, it's IDM, you idiot. And I kind of feel like just throwing that label on it is a little disingenuous and maybe a little bit of a cop-out, just because it seems like compositionally you're doing something way different than, let's say, an Aphex Twin or an Autechre.
Yeah, you know, if I wanted to be super pretentious, I would put a lot of words now as like, oh, my music is immersive, it's very three-dimensional sonic experience and stuff. but honestly, I still don't know what it is. I'm trying to figure it myself. Maybe in 2 years, if we talk again, I'm gonna find a good word for it, a proper word that describes the music. But for now, I think it shouldn't be named anything.
I think IDM to me is such an older style of music where, I mean, while I wouldn't exactly liken you directly to a guy like Flying Lotus, I think what you have going has a lot more in common with a lot of modern beat music than it does any sort of 90s electronic music producer from the UK.
Yeah, I think so. I'm totally with you on that, and I really appreciate the Flying Lotus reference, because he does a lot of samples and he does a lot of harmonies and basically sample-based compositions, which I'm really into it, actually.
Sure.
And yeah, so I would say that's a pretty good reference, that kind of beat music, because IDM, I'm not comfortable with the word, actually, But intelligent. Even
most people, yeah. Even most people who are who have been given the label throughout the years aren't that cool with the label.
It's a funny one. IDM. All these, yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's a strange.
You wouldn't call yourself intelligent, would you?
I mean, would I label my reviews intelligent music reviews?
Intelligent music review. IMR.
Maybe if I were in a position where I was ready to quit, and I didn't have to deal with the backlash of anybody being like, Anthony, you're being a fucking asshole, and then I could maybe sort of preemptively, not preemptively, but sort of in post, place that label on my reviews as a bit of a fuck you to everybody who is going to be, you know, sticking around afterwards, just to be like, sayonara, suckers.
This is me. I'm intelligent, and I just made the best reviews ever.
Sure.
Not that you didn't. You did.
We're not even going to go down that road. We're not even going to entertain that conversation.
Yeah.
So moving on from here, sort of now that you have this audience, and you know you're thinking about performing, sort of where do your creative ambitions lie, or is sort of the idea to kind of sit and let things ruminate, or just start to quickly start working on the next project? Because it seems now more than ever, in order to sort of hold people's attention, you've got to constantly be dropping shit. To sort of,
I don't know,
tell
if
people like, oh, I'm not going anywhere. I'm still here.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in terms of like labels and stuff, is it appropriate to say this? But I already have finished another record, which is another 25-minute piece, and I'm in the middle of another one, which is around 45 minutes. So I'm just constantly putting things together as a habit, basically. It's just my habit. I don't know if this sounds lame. Yeah, this sounds really bad as well. It's like, I'm just making music. Yeah, but yeah, I'm really intrigued and fascinated by the whole sonic experience. Even if I'm doing other stuff, I'm experiencing films and other stuff just in arts. So yeah, I just want to make music.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's a great passion to have, it's fine to just kind of leave it simply as that. To move from London, you know, sort of what brings you to the city? Because I know that you didn't grow up there, from what I understand.
Yeah, I've been here for 6 years now.
Okay.
And I don't sound English.
Well, that's fine. So where are you coming from to sort of
I come from Iran. I grew up in Iran. I was born and raised in Iran, in Tehran, the capital city, and I was always doing music there. I studied in the Tehran College of Music.
And were you learning classical music there?
Yeah. I was studying classical composition there.
Oh, okay. And when you're doing classical composition in Iran, I mean, are you learning sort of classical music directly from your culture, or are you taking like classes on Western classical music?
There are two different pathways. There's one that is specializing on Iranian traditional music, but there's also a big side that is European classical music, which I was interested in Chopin and Wagner mostly. So yeah, I was doing classical composition theory and playing a bit of piano, cello, different instruments. In that environment, because the college I was going to, it was called World Music. Classical music was a part of the world music, so I kind of studied jazz music a bit as well. I did a lot of bass, jazz bass.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What jazz artists were sort of key to the curriculum over there?
I was really into Grant Green.
Hmm.
And I listened to a lot of Miles Davis.
Hmm.
And I was playing a lot of bass lines from... which one was it? Let me remember that. Oh, Victor Wooten.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So electric bass?
As a kid. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, things got pretty funky at some point, and I tried to imitate Marcus Miller. I just tried to experience everything when I was younger.
Well, those are some pretty heavyweight bass players. to be imitating at what age?
17, 18.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Were there other people you were hanging out with at that time who were sort of into a lot of the same jazz music and stuff like that?
Yeah,
Anybody who you were sort of playing with and improvising with?
Yeah, I had a couple of friends who did jazz guitar courses in Iran. And, well, it's very limited, obviously, since it's a very westernized music.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's pretty big, since we had a lot of jazz records from the 70s in Iran, jazz record collectors, basically.
Oh.
So there was a big source of really super old records. I actually found this organ from 1969 in Iran, and I still have it here. I brought it over.
You brought it over to London?
Yeah, to London. It's a pretty old Yamaha what is a combo organ.
And your experience and your interest in jazz music and classical music obviously sort of started over there, but did you start branching out into electronic music there, or did you start doing that once you kind of landed in London?
No, I started when I was 18. I had this computer and a software called Cool Edit Pro.
So before Adobe Audition bought Cool Edit and turned
Cool
it in.
Edit. That's the best name ever.
I used to. I've worked in radio for years, and that is the program that we use. Man, fucking Cool Edit. I haven't heard anybody use. I haven't heard anybody say they use that program for a long time.
Yeah, because that program had the best. I can easily say the best noise reduction application.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember.
That's actually a really good point, because a friend
it had
of mine
the
and
best
I.
Noise sampling, and you could take the sample from the noise and put the sample on the whole thing, and it would reduce the noise really beautifully.
I used to actually. I don't do this as much recently, but when I was first getting into record collecting, I would buy a lot of shitty beat up records, and then I would just digitize them and record them using Cool Edit Pro. And the noise reduction plugin on that program would pull the pops and the clicks out like beautifully.
It was amazing. I don't know what technology they use that they don't use it anymore.
Yeah, and the thing is, there were so many things about that program that were just easy to use.
Exactly. That's why I got into sampling. So I had this really bad, like, crappy microphone.
Sure.
I was sampling everything from the room, from my guitar, clicks, and people shouting in the other room. So I would record them and put them in Cool Edit Pro, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And reduce the noise and just mess around with them. I didn't know that's called, like, electronic digital music, where you do things on your computer.
Sure.
Yeah, I was trying to imitate real music. Maybe that's why. Because back then I was trying to make classical pieces, but with everything that I had, anything that I had in the room. So, yeah, I ended up just making pieces. I don't know if I have those pieces, but those are the most precious pieces of music I ever made.
Well, I mean, obviously you're not still using Cool Edit Pro now.
No, I'm not.
so what have you graduated to now that you're not using Cool Edit?
Yeah, I'm on Logic.
Oh, okay.
Logic is pretty cool.
You know, again, everybody, if you can go back, if you have if you're still running Windows 2000 or Windows XP, please hop online and try to pirate yourself a copy of Cool Edit Pro. Because it was just super easy to just, like, cut stuff and paste stuff and just, like, you know, control and copy and paste stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And just some of the manipulations in that program were kind of cool. I mean, I've had my experiences in that program. There were some difficult things in there, like sort of equalizing things was difficult on the fly, because you would sort of turn down maybe the you would like roll down like the lowest frequencies, and then it wouldn't actually happen until like a second later. Like you couldn't gradually turn stuff down or up.
You would just
turn it down and hope that it fell into a place that actually sounded good. And then if it didn't, it would just kind of be this guessing game of like jumping around with the equalizer and whatever other plugin you were using, because nothing would sort of, you know, sort of fade up louder or fade down louder or get more distorted sort of, you know, easily. It would just, you know, you'd turn the button and then it would just like turn up to that volume or whatever.
I don't want to sound like an old guy, but these days plugins just, they do everything for you and you don't want them to, kind of, and you're like, hey whoa, I didn't want that to be like that. But
sure,
they're just doing it. You can easily get carried away with the automations and like automatic settings and basically presets.
Yeah, because it's I imagine it, instead of just giving you a blank slate, you throw in the plugin and it's kind of already implying what you want before you've even made any adjustments.
Exactly. And you're guided by some kind of semi-intelligent machines.
Sure. And
back to that artificial intelligence.
Yes, artificial intelligence informing us. But there's also the element of, I'm making a song, I have this idea in my head for the way the reverb should sound, I throw on the reverb plugin, and it's already got this other reverb on it, and all of a sudden in my head I've already lost the way that the reverb is supposed to sound, because the computer has shown me this other reverb, and it's fucked up my notion of how I want it to sound.
Exactly. You don't have the idea of the room that you wanted to simulate with the reverb, basically.
Sure.
So you kind of lose that size. And that's what I tried to do with this record, is that I set up the empty room first. I had this image of the room. This is the room that I want to put these sonic objects in.
Hmm.
So basically, when you listen to this album, you come to my room and you see the way I decorate things. I've put the sonic objects, basically, the sounds.
I think that's a really good way to sort of play off of something that you said earlier. When you said you were composing these tracks, you didn't necessarily know where you are. And that was one of the more perplexing things about me when listening to this record and trying to just review it and find a way to describe it. It doesn't really have it doesn't really have sort of a strong sense of place or being or belonging to any one thing or setting. Not that I don't think it has a personality or anything like that, but sort of because it's the place that this thing exists in just seems so abstract. I can't really visualize it.
Yeah, it's somewhere. I don't even know what the address is.
this room that this stuff exists in, what does it even look like to you in your
video,
mind's
basically,
eye?
Basically, the first video that was released on...
You just dropped a video. We will put a link to the music video that you just dropped down in the description box, because you did just release a music video. So you kind of see that video as like an accurate representation of kind of what your music is visually.
The guidelines are representing a sort of unknown environment.
Sure.
And I'm really happy that Herod had that in mind as well. He was always talking about this like unknown space, that things are happening there, and you see these objects and these creatures, basically.
Mm.
Yeah, I think the room, you get the definition of a room, but it's not real. It's just an idea of a room. So it's not a real place or a real space that I could actually define or say this is how it looks like or this is how it is. It's just an unknown space. It's somewhere in all of our heads, basically, every one of us. We could just travel with sound to somewhere that we don't actually know anything about it.
I think that's pretty much a great description of what this record does. Yeah. I think that's and a good note to end on as well. If you give a listen to this new record, which we will link you down to in the description as well, just sort of that lack of knowing where you are is kind of the sensation that I think comes out strongest on this record, which could kind of be a scary thing too.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of music, I think most popular music is very closely and obviously tied to some kind of culture or scene or background of some sort. And to sort of listen to music that doesn't have any strong, you know, cultural roots in any one thing can be kind of strange, because, you know, sort of cultural background and experience is how a lot of people identify with the music that they're listening to, whether it be punk music or hip hop music or country music or metal music, which is, you know, very insular a lot of the time, and certain forms of electronic music too. This is why people sort of get defensive with a lot of stuff, especially when you're saying negative things about music, because it's not like you're just saying the music isn't good. You know, you're also kind of saying, and not directly, but it kind of feels this way in a sense. You know, you're also saying that the culture, sort of the idea or the background that this record is coming from, you're sort of, I guess, putting that down as well. You know, it's kind of hard to give something a negative review or give something a positive review without having all this other baggage carry over with it. You know, I'm sure you've had an experience before where you've loved the way a record sounds or you really love the music, but maybe you don't totally identify with the point of view of the record or maybe the politics of the record or the message of the record.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of hip hop that sometimes I don't just connect to. Sometimes, but when I listen to the lyrics more and more, I'm getting into the story. Unless it has like super crazy nice beats, but if it doesn't, if it's just about the words, it takes time to get to know the person that is saying those things, because it comes from the streets that the stories happened in them, the houses, the environment, the people who were involved in these stories. So you have to get to know them.
Sure. And that's
sometimes,
and that's,
doesn't happen. Yeah.
And the thing is, that sort of familiarity is what people enjoy in music a lot of the time, knowing that the artist has had a similar experience, or at least that the song is delivering an experience or a setting or a place that the person who's listening to it is familiar with or identifies with in some kind of significant way. Whereas, you know, when I'm listening to what you're doing, I don't see a house, I don't see a street, I don't see a place, I don't see a background or anything. I just see this kind of weird, abstract, you know, bizarro land. That is just, again, difficult to make heads or tails of. It just seems like this super duper abstract thing that, you know, nothing.
Way,
you know.
I think, which in a way, it's kind of good as well for the listener.
Oh yeah, it's good. It's very good.
Yeah, to kind of get people to push themselves into another world and come out of the safe zone sometimes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, a lot of people do. Yeah. A lot of people do. I'm just saying that for some people, you know, sort of listening to music that doesn't have those clear cultural definitions can be kind of scary.
That's true. Yeah, now I can totally understand what you're saying now.
It's kind of like just getting... It's like getting blown out of the airlock in the middle of space. Yes. And, you know, instead of enjoying the ride and just enjoying the fact that you're kind of in this spot where maybe there's, you know, no rules or no definitions or anything like that, you know, you're thinking about, whoa, nothing around me is familiar.
Yeah, which has, at the same time that it has this the sense of discovery, at the same time it has the loneliness. It gives you that feel. I think, for me, sometimes, it gives me that feeling of being lonely between these unknown random sounds. But I think the discovery excites me so much that I forget about interacting with anything else, but just seeing new things, feeling new things. Yeah, I refer to sound as seeing, or like in that way, because I kind of see sound more than I listen to it sometimes. I try to make objects. I'm a strong believer in synesthesia.
I'm imagining you don't actually experience synesthesia though, correct?
Yeah, but what
I'm going to ask you is, having established that you don't have synesthesia, how do you sort of imagine it or experience it?
Have it or not? That's a very difficult thing to say.
Uh-huh.
But when I make stuff, because some of the elements that are in electronic music mostly, some of the elements, they don't have any classical definition of sound or instrument. So basically, you cannot name them or describe them. The only thing you have is an image of this object in your head that can fill the spectrum of the empty room in your headphones or in the speaker. Mm. So you're just filling this empty space with sounds. And I think most of the time you see them as objects in your head. You feel them. It's like sometimes I remember as a kid, when I was a kid, I would see big objects, like unknown objects, in my dreams at night. I wouldn't say they were nightmares, but I had these objects in my head that would pass slowly or move really quickly and then suddenly stop. And I always had this question in my head, what are these? Are these real objects or visions? And they would give me a sense of sound as well, like low bass with this big bubble. Or you could see a hi-hat as a metal piece moving or scratching. So sometimes I put sounds as objects that I see and I can't describe it in words. Mm. I couldn't say this is like a purple stone or something. It's just something. It's a sound. I see them. I see them moving. So yeah, I was thinking it would be cool to try and experience this in a visual format as well, which I'm trying to do with Herod these days, trying to turn this album into objects that move and you experience them in a virtual reality format.
And do you I feel like in the digital age, there's so much pressure because of just the way everybody is so oversaturated with entertainment and information. There's so much pressure to create visuals that accompany your music because just the music itself isn't, you know, sort of attention grabbing enough. But it seems like for you, sort of pairing your music with visuals, with music videos, is kind of like something that was sort of always meant to be, in a way.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the whole basis of my musical composition, which is visual.
Strange visuals.
Yeah, I would say strange, because some bits, if you hear more classical chords or movements in the music, you could easily see them on scenery or film, parts of films. But I wouldn't put these noises on normal life routines or just scenery, like scenes from a street or a city. I would try to go deep into the sound as it's kind of the same as the nano composition concept, where you go in, it's like a microscope, you go into the sound. So with digital objects, I'm trying to go deep into objects that are created and they just melt and have really weird behavior.
Well, I wish you all the luck with creating those results with visuals and sounds into the future.
It's in the middle of the process, I would say. It's we constantly experimenting new things. So
okay, yeah. Well, you know, I'm just hit me up, hit us up when the next stuff is coming out, when these final results have risen to the top.
Yeah, I'm really kind of now that is out on your the album is out on your channel, I'm like keen to have the album on your channel again, like the next album as soon as it's out. Yes, your channel is pretty addictive.
Oh wow. And, thank you very much. Cool. Let's stop complimenting each other here.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We'll just
big fan.
We'll put an ending on this thing. Finally,
yeah, let's just end this.
And we'll say, go down in the description box again. Check out this guy's latest record. Check out his latest music video, and any other relevant information we could put down there. And then I just want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Anthony. It was great talking to you. It was really fun.
It was good talking to you too. Whoa, Anthony Fantano. Ash Kusha, good music forever.